Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
What verse is up there? 5? Okay, but we didn't finish 4. We didn't even get close to finishing it, so we'll continue with 4. Vishuddha Sattvam Tavadam Ashantam. Go ahead, see if you can do it. Vishuddha Sattvam Tavadam Ashantam Tato Tapo Mayam Dvasta Rajas Tamaskam Tapo Mayam Dvasta Rajas Tamaskam Mayi Mayo Ayam Gunasam Pravaho Maya Mayoyam guna sampravaho na vidyate grahanam anubhav anuban. I can't even do it when I'm reading it. What to speak of you doing it and following me? Na vidyate te agrahan anubanda.
Na vidyate
te anubanda. Indra said, your transcendental form. Who is he speaking to? Who is Indra speaking to? And where is Krishna when he's saying this? Sitting at the foot of Govardhan. Your transcendental form, a manifestation of pure goodness, is undisturbed by change. It is shining with knowledge and devoid of passion and ignorance. In you does not exist the mighty flow of the modes of material nature, which is based on illusion and ignorance. I'll read from the purport. I'll read the, because we didn't read very much. We read up to describing what dham means. Because the word in here, Vishuddha Sattvam Tavadham Ashantam. The great Bhagavatam commentator, Srila Sridhar Swami, has masterfully explained the Sanskrit elements of this profound verse. What does profound mean?
Deep.
It is deep. It is very deep. Deep means it has very hidden meanings. And if you hear the commentary of the Acharyas, those meanings become revealed. Very hidden meanings that are wonderful, substantial. The Sanskrit word dham has several meanings: dwelling place, house, abode, and so on, a favorite thing or person, delight or pleasure, form or appearance, power, strength, majesty, glory, splendor, or light. Concerning the first set of meanings, the Vedanta Sutra states that the Absolute Truth is the source and resting place of all existence. And in the first verse of the Bhagavatam, the Absolute Truth is said to be Krishna. Although Lord Krishna exists in his own dham, or abode called Krishna Loka, he himself is the abode of all existence. As Arjuna confirms in the Bhagavad Gita, where he addresses Krishna as Param Dham, the supreme abode, everything rests in him. The very name Krishna indicates the all-attractive person, and thus Lord Krishna, the source of all beauty and pleasure, is certainly the favorite thing or person, delight and pleasure. So that's the second meaning of Dham, favorite thing or person, delight or pleasure. So Krishna is that as well. He is the abode of everything, but because everything wonderful and exalted exists within him, he is naturally a favorite thing, the most favorite thing or person. He's naturally the greatest delight and the greatest pleasure. Indeed, Krishna is an ocean of pleasure, a reservoir of pleasure. And we, if we can just get the smallest drop of that pleasure, we will be satisfied. Ultimately, All these terms can refer only to Krishna, because he's saying that ultimately Krishna is the only delight, he is the only pleasure. And if we turn away from Krishna, the Supreme Lord, and try to get delight and pleasure in a different way, instead of getting what we so desire, we attain misery. Dham also refers to form or appearance. That's the third meaning. And as Indra offered these prayers, he was in fact directly seeing the form of Krishna before him. As clearly explained in the Vedic literature, Lord Krishna's power, strength, majesty, splendor, and effulgence are all contained within his transcendental body, and thus attest to the infinite glories of the Lord. Srila Sridhar Swami has brilliantly summarized all these meanings of the word Dham by giving the Sanskrit term Sarup as a synonym. The word Sarup means one's own form or shape, and also one's own condition, character, or nature. Since Lord Krishna, being pure spirit, is none different from his body, there is absolutely no difference between the Lord and his visible form. What does that mean? There is no difference between the Lord and his visible form. Yes. Yes, but what does it mean? Yes, but what does it mean? His body is transcendental, he's absolute, but what does it mean? You're both correct. That there's no difference between the Lord and his visible form. You're answering the question, why is that true? But what does it mean? Yes. Excuse me? Yes. So just like we say, we are not our body, but we are soul. This is Krishna's words from the Bhagavad Gita. We are not our bodies, we are souls. And we are not our name. What's your name? Excuse me?
Guru.
Guru, okay. Very good. Just Guru. Huh? Guru Krishna Nam? Guru Krishna, that's such a...
Guru Krishna Ram.
Yes, Guru Krishna Ram. Yes, it's a big name. So we say that we are not our body and we are not our name. Wait 1 second, please. So, but Krishna is his body. When we leave this world, the soul leaves and the body is left behind, lifeless. But Krishna's body is not composed of matter. It is composed of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. It is fully spiritual. And that is him. There is not a soul, as in our case, giving life to a dead body. There is life in every part of Krishna's body. It is conscious. And each part, angani yasya sakalendriya vrittimanti, each part can perform the activities of any other part. He has not an ordinary body, but an extraordinary body, completely spiritual. So Krishna's body is composed of the spiritual nature. It is eternal, blissful, and full of knowledge. And our body is composed of the material nature. And what gives life to that body is the soul. And that is us. Sometimes we can say we have a soul. But actually, it's philosophically, it's not correct. It's not that we have a soul. We are the soul. We are that soul within us. That is us. And the symptom of that soul is consciousness. And as soon as that soul or consciousness leaves the body is no different from a piece of wood. And if you've ever seen a dead body, you'll know that this is true. It is no different. A dead body means, what does a dead body mean? A body with no soul in it. But in fact, A body is never alive. Just like a car, we don't say a live car and a dead car. The car is a car, it has nothing. What gives life to the car? Huh? You could have a fuel and you could have an engine, and if the person isn't there to turn the key, there's no life in the car. It's the person who gives life to the car. So similarly, it is the soul that gives life to this body. And again, if you've ever seen a dead body, whether it's a cat or a dog, has anyone ever seen a dead monkey? Yes? Very rare. Even in Vrindavan, I don't know what happens. Either they don't die or they just hide. Either the other monkeys quickly take them away and do whatever they do to them, or they go to a special place to leave this world, knowing that they're going to leave. So, since Lord Krishna, being pure spirit, is none different from his body, there's absolutely no difference between the Lord and his visible form. That means that Krishna, even the deity of Krishna, the vigraha, the form of Krishna, is Krishna with all the potency that Krishna possesses. So therefore we pray to the deity, and Krishna can reciprocate with us fully through the deity if Shradhan Vita, if we worship with deep faith and understand this point deeply. We can get full reciprocation with Krishna because he and his form are the same. By contrast, in this material world, we conditioned souls are all distinctly different from our bodies. Whether those bodies be male, female, black, white, or whatever, all of us are eternal souls different from our temporary, flimsy bodies. And when we understand this point, therefore we can understand why in this world everyone is so dissatisfied. And if we go back to the example of the car, there's a person in the car and he's giving life to the car. He turns the key. He puts his foot on the gas pedal and the brake and changes the gears. And if he just takes care of the car, if he puts fuel in the car, if he keeps the engine free from oil leaks, and if he cleans the outside of the car and cleans the inside of the car, but doesn't care, doesn't feed himself, the person within the vehicle, then he will die, he will feel miserable. But due to a full identification of ourself as being our car, meaning our body, yantra, we are feeding the body but neglecting the person within the body, and therefore there is a feeling of starvation that everyone carries with them no matter what they do. No matter what they do, there is a feeling of being starved. And we look to solve the problem on the physical level because there's a feeling of starvation, and we look for solving the problem on the intellectual level, on the emotional level, but actually we need to solve the problem on the actual level of the soul, on our true identity. If the soul becomes nourished, then he experiences the satisfaction that he longs for. But there must be transcendental knowledge of the difference between the soul and the body, and also knowledge about what nourishes the soul. That we must know. Knowledge about what actually gives the soul the nourishment that he is longing for. Then for that we have to know who the soul is. When the word sarup is applied to us, it especially indicates our spiritual form, because our own form is in fact our own condition, character, or nature eternally. That is who we are. So who are we? What is the natural me? Who is that natural me? Who am I? Just like I may be wearing this chadar, I may put this silk cloth on me, and I may think this is me. But it isn't me. I can throw it away, it will get old, I will change it. And the same is true for this whatever it is. And the layer underneath it, and the layer underneath that, and also the layer underneath that is skin. You could take that off too, and I'll still be there. You can take off the elbow from here down, I'll still be there. This isn't me. Who is me? If I look in the mirror and think that's me, no wonder I'm unhappy. And if I think the body is me, then I'll have to answer the question, well, which body is me? Is it the body when I looked in the mirror and saw a 3-year-old? Is that me? Or is the body when I was 20 staring back at me? Is that me? So which body is me if I'm identifying with the body? Is it the 50-year-old body, the 3-year-old body, the 7-year-old body, the 60-year-old body? No, actually, there's been a continuity of identity throughout all these changes of bodies. I've always existed, but I've been thinking of myself as that body, but that's not me. What is actually my form? Who am I? What is me uncovered from all these layers? The physical, the mental, intellectual, false ego. Who am I? This is the quest of life. What is my sarup? So, Mahaprabhu says, jivera, sarup hoy, the actual identity, the actual form, the natural characteristic is Krishna's eternal servant. That is who we are. And if we feed that, if we feed our relationship with Krishna, then we will flourish. That means that the feeding of the soul is the hearing and chanting of Krishna's names and the other processes of devotional service. That feeds the soul. And his identity grows. In other words, it develops. It develops like a seed grows into a small plant and then finally into a creeper, and then it gives its fruits and flowers. So the fruit, if we take care of this plant properly, the fruit is prema, or love for Krishna. And that, and only that, will satisfy us. When we are awake in our relationship with Krishna, that is who we are. We are Krishna's servant. We are Krishna's, and we belong to him, and he belongs to us. When we are alive in that, then we are alive. That is the manifestation of the soul's true identity. So when the word sarup is applied to us, it especially indicates our spiritual form, because our own form is in fact our own condition, character, or nature eternally. Thus the liberated condition in which one's outward form is one's deepest spiritual nature is called sarup. When we attain our outer form is different from our inner form. The mind, there's two inner forms. There's one that's composed of subtle matter. That's the mind, intelligence, and ego. Sukshma sariya, the subtle body. And then there's the soul himself. When that form is developed, and there's an example given in the Bhagavatam of Narada Muni. He was cultivating Krishna consciousness so deeply. And actually, he went to the forest. When he was a little boy, even younger than some of the young lads in this very room, but not younger than all of them. But something very unfortunate happened. Something very fortunate happened is that he met some exalted personalities and he heard from them and he served them, some great devotees, the Bhaktivedantas. And then they left. And in fact, he wanted to go with them. But he couldn't. He was bound in his relationship with his mother. But then, as fate had it, one day his mother went out to milk a cow early in the morning and she was bitten by a snake and she left this world. And Narada Muni then, he saw, this is a terrible thing on one level, but this must be Krishna's hand. And he had no other attachments to bind him in this world. He wasn't entangled in any other relationships or anything. He just left. He left and began wandering throughout the world, gaining experience of what life is, what the world is like, based on the teachings that he had heard from the Bhaktivedantas. So he wandered in the forests of the world, and the villages, and the towns, and the agricultural lands, all over. And then one day, because he was seeing what, with his intelligence, what is actually going on here? He was seeing. So he didn't, his knowledge wasn't just theoretical. And then at one point he went into a forest that was very, very beautiful. There were sweet breezes blowing. And he sat down to perform yogic meditation. And suddenly Krishna himself appeared in his heart. This was by Krishna's mercy. And he became so ecstatic because the Lord had appeared in his heart. And then just as quickly as he appeared, he disappeared. And then he became completely forlorn, disturbed, and he jumped up. And then he sat down and tried to gain the Lord again in his heart by his meditation. He was unable. And then he heard a voice. Antayanasmi. No, I can't remember the Namam Drastum Ivarhiti. You do not, unfortunately, my dear Narada, you cannot see me again in this life. Dudarsayam kuyogina. Ivapakwam. You have immature and you have kashayanam. You still have some impurities in your heart. But I've appeared before you to increase your eagerness to see me. Okay, let me ask you a question. He had an incredible spiritual experience. He saw the Lord and then the Lord disappeared from him. Was he fortunate or unfortunate? What do you think? Yes. But how come, everyone will say that he was fortunate, but how come we think of our highest Krishna conscious experiences and how wonderful they were, and then we don't have them right now, but how come we don't feel we are fortunate? We think, oh, this bro, you know, depressed about it. Oh, I don't like Krishna consciousness. I want to do this. I don't want to do this anymore, or something. Or, oh, is it, I get involved. No, it's the most fortunate thing to have a deep Krishna conscious experience. And how did Narada deal with this? He lived the remainder of his life longing for that, because it was so exalted and wonderful. He did not want to fill up the emptiness that he was feeling without it with anything trite or mundane, because there was nothing comparable to that. So he just spent the remaining years of his life, which were quite a few, just chanting and chanting and chanting and hearing about Krishna. He did not want anything else. And then, at a certain point, His eagerness, as he did that, his eagerness just increased. Tattaloyam api mulamikalam. And at some point, he died. Of course, looking at it from the spiritual point of view, we can't say he died. But his material body dropped. And the example that Narada Muni gives is just like lightning and illumination. There's a lightning flash. And how long does it take when the lightning comes and the illumination to come? What is the distance in time between the two, the appearance of lightning and the appearance of the illumination of the lightning? It is simultaneous. And in the same way, as Narada dropped his material body, his spiritual body manifest instantaneously. So you can say he died, but that's very superficial. So his sarup, which is the point, his sarup manifest, he was so mature, he had gotten rid of the kashayanam and the ivapakwa. He got rid of the things, his lack of maturity and the impurities in his heart by longing to be with Krishna and always chanting his name. That cleanses the heart of all these things. So, when the liberated condition in which one's outward form is one's deepest spiritual nature is called sarup. Primarily, however, this term refers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. This is all indicated in this verse by the words tava dhamma, as explained by Sridhar Swami. Sridhar Swami has explained that here the word shantam means always in the same form. Shantam can also mean undisturbed, free from passion, or purified. According to Vedic philosophy, all changes in this world is caused by the influence of passion and ignorance. The passionate mode is creative, and the ignorant mode is destructive, whereas the mode of goodness, sattva, is serene and sustaining. In many ways, this verse emphasizes that Lord Krishna is free from the modes of nature. The word Vishuddham Sattvam, Shantam, Drasvarajas Tamaskam, and Guna Sampravaho Navidyate all indicate this, that Krishna, his transcendental form, is beyond the modes of material nature. It has nothing to do with the material world. Nothing to do with the material world. It is spiritual. It is his swarup. Unlike Krishna, we change from one body to another because of our involvement with the modes of nature. The various transformations of material forms are impelled by the modes of nature, which are themselves set in motion by the influence of time. What are the modes of material nature set in motion by? The influence of time. Time is the great, it moves everything in this world. Whether we like it or not. When we're young, do we want to be younger or older? I'll ask you a question. Not that I'm implying that you're young or anything.
Younger.
What's the? You're not young. What age would you like? How old are you now?
30.
And how old would you like to be? Yes, you do. Take a guess.
Older.
What would be better?
Older.
How much older? What age would be really good? 18. Why 18? You can drive a car, yeah. Okay. So when you're young, you want to be older. And when you're older, you want to be?
Younger.
But the younger one
can't be older until his time comes, and the older one can't be younger until his time comes, because we are under the control. It's always, it's interesting, isn't it, though, if you think about it, that the younger ones want to be older and the older one wants to be younger. No one is happy the way they are. No offense. Everyone wants to be something other than what they are, because the soul isn't fully nourished, and we dream. It's what I call the, I've mentioned it before, the only if dream. Only if then. Only if blank, 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 then I would be happy. Only if that and that and that, then I'd be happy. But actually, when our desires are not centered around who we actually are, whatever we have. Bashan, how old would you like to be? Okay. How old would you like to be? How old would you like to be? So, but we can't stop, because kalosmin lokat chaya krit, the forces, the force of time is unstoppable, because it is Krishna's potency. It is unstoppable, moving the modes of material nature, moving everything material, causing it to go through different transformations and ultimately to dissolution. That's the force of time. It's unstoppable. But time does not touch who we are, the soul, because the soul itself is eternal. It is not material, and time only affects those things of matter. Thus, the word shantim indicates that the Lord is undisturbed by change. He is free from the material modes of nature. According to this verse, the powerful flow of the material modes of nature, namely passion, stupidity, which is ignorance, and mundane piety, are based on agrahana, which Srila Sridharaswami has translated as ignorance. Since the Sanskrit word gra means to take, accept, grasp, or comprehend, grahana means grasp, exactly in the sense of to grasp an idea or fact. Therefore, agrahana here means one's failure to understand. Grahana means to hold, to grasp. And agrahana means the failure, the inability, or the lack of having grasped. So agrahana means one's failure to understand one's spiritual position. And this failure causes one to fall into the violent currents of material existence. An additional meaning of the word agrahana is derived when it is divided into the compound agra and hana. Agra means the first, top, or best. Where are you from?
Agra.
Yes. It means the capital. It was the capital. The best and hana means killing. Agra means the first, top, or best, and hana means killing. The best part of our existence is the pure soul, which is eternal, in contradistinction to the temporary material body and mind. Thus, one who chooses material existence over Krishna consciousness is in fact killing the best part of himself, the soul, which in its pure state can enjoy Krishna consciousness unlimitedly. Srila Sridharaswami has translated tapo mayam as full of knowledge. The word tapas, generally indicating austerity, is derived from the Sanskrit word tap, whose meaning can be summarized as indicating the various functions of the sun. So this is a very philosophical purport, and Indra's prayers are quite philosophical. Tap means to burn, to shine, to heat, and so on. The Supreme Lord is eternally perfect, and therefore here, tapomayam does not indicate that his transcendental body is meant for austerities, since austerities are performed by conditioned souls to purify themselves or to acquire a particular power. Why are austerities, what is the process by which austerities purify us? And what is the process by which austerities give us a particular power? So, two questions on austerities. So, and first, why, in what sense do austerities purify us? Excuse me? Yes?
We experience some sense control.
Yes. What does austerity mean? We'll start there. Yes.
Voluntarily. Undergoing some inconvenience for a high cause.
Yes, exactly. That definition's in. It's a nectar of devotion or something like that?
I think I've got a little dictionary.
Okay.
But I think it might be in
there. Yeah. Mean, say it again. To voluntarily.
Undergoing some inconvenience for a high cause.
Yes. Voluntarily undergoing inconvenience for a higher cause. And put that together with what Nityananda Priyaprabhu said. So we, for the purpose of controlling, because usually we obey our senses. Our senses want to eat and we have to eat immediately. Our senses want this and we have to drink. Our senses, the mind immediately attaches and accepts whatever the senses want. And it's very, very dangerous to be under the control of the senses and the mind. And this concept is unknown in contemporary civilization, and therefore the young people, their training in their childhood and youth is whatever you want, you get. And the whole society is geared towards presenting sense objects to the young and old people. And when and you see this and immediately I want it. And in this way, the exploiters of this world take our money and exploit us. But our soul dies, because if we're always involved in I want based on the senses, we have neither time nor mind nor inclination to perform the austerities, purification, and we will also have no taste for a spiritual life if our taste is on that level. If we're always watching movies all the time, that's all one can do. If you go into, you walk past the streets of any city and you see the young boys, especially in the video game parlors, and they're just, and they're living in this, and there's so much ignorance in that, and they're living, practically speaking, in an imaginary world in which they're driving a fast car or something like that. They're killing so many powerful opposing warriors. It's insanity, actually. So they're paying for that with their money, but they're paying for that in a much more deadly way, because they're paying for it with their taste. Because once you get a taste of that kind of illusion, it's so hard to perform the required things to actually attain something in this world. You know, if just for a 50 cents or a dollar or $2 you can become a great hero and defeat so many opposing elements, It doesn't allow you, it disallows you to actually, if you want to become strong and powerful and defeat opposing elements, you have to train, you have to work so hard. You have to compete with so many other people. So no, I'd rather put my 50 cents or a dollar into the machine and imagine I'm them like that. So it keeps one living in an imaginary world where one is something, where one is not. It's like this world is already in an illusory world. So this is an illusory world in an illusory world. So the illusion is deeper and thicker. But worse still, then it stops one. It fills one with so many mundane, foolish desires in this illusory world that one loses. One cannot even fathom a spiritual taste because the ignorance is so strong, and you can't have the two tastes going on simultaneously, because spiritual taste, where it's so simple. What do? We sit here, stand in front of the deities, and we sing. And you ask 95% of young people, especially if they have a liking for those kind of things, if such a thing of standing in front of the deities and singing is fun, they'll say, oh, it's so boring. It's bitter like poison. But if one gains that taste, the simple, pure taste of pleasing Krishna by chanting his names and hearing about him, then that gives nourishment to the soul and gives true satisfaction. While the other one, happiness within the mode of ignorance, within all that illusion, just causes so much destructive trouble in one's consciousness and in one's life. So it kills the better part of our existence. So austerity, on one level, we neglect something that we want to do voluntarily for the purpose of gaining something better. So in spiritual life there are austerities, but also in material life, if you want to gain any position or achieve something, you have to work in such an incredible way and voluntarily give up your weekends. You have to work such long hours to gain anything. You have to practice. You have to talk to people you don't like. You have to flatter them. So many austere things to gain what you want. You have to go hours without eating. You have to neglect the family. These high achieving people really do this. They perform such austerities to gain something. So austerity is required, and Krishna conscious austerities are relatively simple. And then the second way is to gain some power, very similar. If you please somebody who's powerful, then he can benedict you, and this is true in the material world. If you become friendly with an extremely wealthy man who has $68 billion, if he really likes you or trusts you and you please him, then what can't he give you in this world? He can give you a situation where you can become a billionaire too. Therefore the saying is, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Especially in which country? Huh? You think it's more in Australia than India? India. Anything and everything is possible with two things. Who you know and a little bit under the table. And it's not very different from Australia, but it's just more hidden. So an omnipotent, so Krishna doesn't have to get what he wants or to quote purify him. He doesn't have to do any of these things. He's already perfectly pure, and he has everything he wants, and he's fully spiritual. And so an omnipotent perfect being neither purifies himself nor acquires powers. He is eternally pure and all powerful. Therefore, Sridhar Swami has intelligently understood that in this case, the word tapas refers to the illuminating function of the sun and thus indicates that the Lord's self-effulgent body is omniscient. Light is a common symbol of knowledge. The Lord's spiritual effulgence does not merely illuminate physically, as in the case of a candle or a light bulb. More importantly, the Lord's body illuminates our consciousness with perfect knowledge because the Lord's effulgence is itself perfect knowledge. We offer our respectful obeisances at the lotus feet of Srila Sridhar Swami and thank him for his enlightening comments on this verse. Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments? Yes.
We started by explaining to us that, that Krishna is absolute, the Lord is absolute, and there is no difference between his soul and his body.
Yes.
Now, in case of the jivas, is there still a difference between the soul and the spiritual body? Or again,
no.
They are the same.
They are the same. The soul for a jiva is a manifestation of his spiritual nature and his desire to serve. As he desires to serve, that spiritual body will manifest. By Krishna's mercy, Krishna even comes in a form. That verse actually explains that Krishna comes as we desire. According to our spiritual desire, Krishna manifests. But according to who we are, which is our spiritual desire, we manifest our true nature in a suitable form to perform that function, that service in relationship with Krishna. And that is us. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
You said that austerity, the definition of austerity is undergoing voluntary some sense control for a higher purpose. So is it like replacing the senses in the spiritual activities like chanting, eating Krishna Prasadam and listening to lectures and other activities, they are also austerities?
Yes. Refraining from material activities. It is an austerity. You walk, you know, people, many of you have worked hard all week. And here it is Saturday morning, and maybe we're tired, and it would be easier to be in bed sleeping, or something like that, and to come to the temple and sit and listen to a class. It's not easy. It takes a determination to do that. Yes. So to refrain from material activities and fill one's consciousness with spiritual activities is an austerity. To eat Krishna prasadam is austerity of the tongue. This is described actually in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, austerities of the mind, the body. To hear shastra is austerity of the mind. To study shastra, yes. So the Krishna conscious austerities are simpler in one sense. Instead of eating improper food, we eat Krishna prasadam. Food that's first offered to Krishna, and that is considered an austerity of the tongue, but it's a very pleasant austerity. We look at the form of Radha Balava and see beauty, and that is austerity of the eyes.
And this austerity has more benefit than the other material austerity.
It gives, once one has a taste, it gives deep, it nourishes the soul, who we are. It provides nourishment because it's the spiritual energy. Keeping ourselves always in touch with the spiritual energy is the essence of a devotee's life. To keep himself always sheltered by the spiritual energy. Always chanting. Always doing something or another that keeps one thinking of Krishna, that keeps one in touch with Krishna. This is the great austerity, and to refrain from immersing ourselves and taking shelter in matter all the time. Material consciousness, material objects. So this is the actual job of a devotee. to somehow or another keep himself fixed in Krishna consciousness regardless of what he's doing externally. Quite correct. Did you have a question, Paul?
Can we say that that goodness isn't a creative force?
Yes.
So how is it that the Lord creates Brahman and creates everything?
Goodness? It looks like when you know, on some days the sun is out and it's not too hot, the weather is perfect, and you've already eaten and you're neither tired nor hungry, and suddenly you don't have that much to do, you don't have a long list of things to do, and suddenly you feel so satisfied in and of yourself. You know that experience? Every once in a while we may have had this. But yes, that's goodness. There's no impetus towards activity. You just feel happy in and of yourself. That's the mode of goodness. So Krishna doesn't directly deal... He is fully self-satisfied. He's the supreme Atmaram, the supreme self-satisfied. But yet the material world has to go on. So through his different energies, he indirectly, not directly, but indirectly, creates Brahma, who is the embodiment of Krishna's creative potency. So Krishna doesn't deal with the mode of passion directly, but only from a far, far, far distance, with his glance, one can say. So he's so indirectly, just like a king is, or the prime minister is the prison department under him. Yes, it's within the category of his ultimately his ultimate portfolio, because everything in the government. But he doesn't deal with the aspects of the prison himself. He does that. He gives someone that portfolio, and then someone gives someone else that portfolio. So it's like that. So indirectly, he practically doesn't have anything to do with it. But yet it is resting upon his potency and his energy. Is that clear? Well, good. Ask more then.
It just seems like
okay, but I'm sorry. Krishna is in that. You're saying that Krishna is in that?
Yes.
Krishna is in pure goodness, not the material mode of goodness, but something else, Vishuddha Sattva. So he's in that in the spiritual world, where there is no tinge of the material energy. And yet the material world is going on, and undoubtedly the material world is resting upon his power. But yet all his consciousness and energy is in the spiritual world. But yet he's so unlimitedly powerful that he's maintaining the whole material world through his agencies and empowered persons. So it doesn't absorb any of his attention, so to speak, or his power, because he's unlimitedly powerful. Mama Angsa Teja Sambhava, the material world takes up the smallest of small portions of his power. Something like that.
But all these agencies and personalities he creates are created by him.
Yes. But there is such a distance, in one sense, between them and him, that he's only, we would say, indirectly involved. This is the inconceivable potency of Krishna. This is called Achintya Bheda Bheda, how everything is ultimately resting on him, and yet he's completely aloof from everything. So if you're having trouble fitting this in between the two ears, it makes sense, because it's Achintya. But we can get some idea. Chinta means it's actually inconceivable. Everything is resting on him, but yet he is apart What chapter of the Bhagavad Gita does Krishna explain this in? Behold my mystic power, Aishwarya. I think it's in the 10th, huh? 10th or, huh? It says that although everything is resting me on the loof, I think it's in the 10th or the 9th. This is one of those two. Behold my inconceivable potencies, that although everything is resting in me, I am separate and independent. Aloof. But yet he's not aloof because nothing could exist if he was fully aloof, if anything was disconnected from him, nothing would exist. Like the king in the prison. It's not that he's always having to think about the prison. So it goes on. No, he's got other important things to do. He gives someone else that portfolio. So Krishna gives Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Gobadakshaya Vishnu, or Vishnu form, his expansion Vishnu, the portfolio of maintaining, creating and destroying this world. But he himself is in Goloka Vrindavan, just enjoying the pastimes there. Is that?
Yeah. I find some part of that challenging, that every time there's a little challenge in faith in God, but in philosophy a little bit, but every time there's a contradictory sort of something a little contradictory, it's part of the inconceivable energy of the world.
Well, there's certain things that are easily explained if you understand the philosophy. But there would be two things. One is that by bhakti, things that are hard to understand at one point become easier to understand at another point as we develop. That's just natural. One sees contradictions, and then as one matures, one understands things on a deeper level. And it doesn't appear contradictory. That's one point. As our bhakti increases, our devotion increases, our understanding of who Krishna is increases, then these contradictions disappear. Second is, Krishna, by definition, practically speaking, or God, has to possess power that is inconceivable to our finite minds. But this one isn't so hard to understand, that he's so extremely powerful, like in the example of the Prime Minister. Do you think his mind is always on what's going on in the prison? But yet it's resting on him, in the point that it's government, and he's in charge of government, and now and then he has to he has to deal with the prison minister or something like that, he has to see what's going on, maybe he'll even visit sometimes, but his mind is on other things. The person who's the in charge, the manager of the prison, his mind is only on the prison. But Krishna is not like that. Krishna is so unlimitedly powerful. He's like a wealthy owner of a huge business, that he can give most of the work to other people. He doesn't do everything himself. But he takes long vacations and this and that. He does what he likes to do. It's already so established. Doesn't require his energy. So that's the second point, that Krishna is unlimitedly powerful and the best manager. So he has everything going on by his potency, and he had his eternal vacation. And Goloka Vrindavan, he just deals with his beloveds. So when the king takes a holiday or the prime minister, what does he do? We don't know in one sense, right? But he, according to his nature, but we know he's with his friends and family. Yeah? And then he can relax and just be himself. So that's Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan, is Krishna revealing the most intimate parts of his nature. What he does when he, what he likes to do, what God likes to do. He likes to deal with his devotees and serve his devotees. So on one level it's not so inconceivable, because it has its parallels, so much of the parallels in the material world. And it's not actually contradictory, because we see it happening, going on all the time. And yet Krishna does possess inconceivable potency. Is that okay, or do you want to ask more? Anyway, something to think about. Okay, let's stop here. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.